If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Thursday, December the 12th, and you're listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Hoover Institution's Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Research Fellow. Joining me today in Hoover's Washington, D.C. office on a rather chilly Thursday, but I'm a Californian, so I'm a weather whip.
I'm a Texan, so.
Oh, even worse for you.
Yeah, way worse.
What part of Texas?
Houston.
Okay. Our guest is former Houstonian, now Washingtonian, Sarah Isker. Sarah Isker is a staff writer for The Dispatch, the new conservative media outlet co-founded by Steve Hayes and Jonah Goldberg, and she is a CNN commentator. Prior to that, Sarah Isker was a top Justice Department spokesperson for former Attorney General Jeff Sessions. She is also has quite the Republican resume when it comes to campaign work. She was a deputy campaign manager for Carly Fiorina's presidential campaign, and she's been in the employment of Mitt Romney, Ted Cruz, and the Republican National Committee. Anybody I left out?
Oh, gosh. I'm sure there are some. You know, your very own Jeff Mershner, I was his intern for Bob Smith, the senator from New Hampshire, back pre-9/11 days. So,
your date is off. Well, welcome to the podcast, and to borrow the words, now is the winner of our discontent in Washington. How discontented is this place on a scale of 1 to 10, and somebody in Washington always having a beef about something? Are these ordinary times, or has impeachment made everything just kind of hyper-beefed?
This week has been a little off the charts, but maybe more because there's so much news. It's hard to even, you know what's going to lead the nightly news on any given moment. You have the IG report coming out. You have impeachment moving forward. You have a trade deal. You have China. You have a shooting. The volcano.
Right.
Can't forget the volcano. I don't think that impeachment has had the sort of deleterious effect on the culture of D.C. that some other moments of the last 3 years, let's say. I think that the Kavanaugh hearings, frankly, were a low point for people being able to civilly talk to each other, far more than right now.
Because of the choice of Brett Kavanaugh, or just what the hearings delved into in terms of beer and high school yearbooks and stuff like that? Or
I don't know. I think I think it was a conversation we were having as a country, and D.C. is usually pretty good about sort of, I'm going to put this in quotes, you know, this town stuff of like, yeah, you know, we fight during the day, but then we go drinking at night at happy hour. And there was something about that, though, that was far more personal for most people on both sides.
You came to Washington to work for Jeff Sessions?
No.
No.
Wait, when...
You were here a while before that.
Yeah,
you?
Yeah.
When did you first come to Washington?
Well, interning for Senator Smith was my first. I remember flying. Mr. Smith comes to Washington moment where the flight path into DCA takes you by the monuments, and that
yes.
was me flying into DC for the first time, and it was crazy, and I was like, I'm never leaving this place. And then I worked on John Cornyn's first Senate race in Austin and then came back the following year and was an intern for Barbara Comstock and Mark Corallo in the Department of Justice Office of Public Affairs in the early Ashcroft days.
That is how a lot of bad movies begin. It's the stars in her eyes, young political aide who flies into Washington. She looks down and there's the mall and there are the monuments and she just couldn't be happier.
No, exactly. I mean,
and
this could have taken – I don't know if you remember this movie. It was – I think – it was nominated for Golden Globe Best Picture, but not Academy Award Best Picture. The Ides of March, based on the play Farragut North.
That's Clooney and
Ryan Gosling. Gosling, yes.
Yes.
I could have gone the Farragut North Ides of March route. I think I haven't. I'm pretty sure.
Explain The Dispatch to me.
I think that in this media environment, and you see the same Pew polls and everything else, trust in media declining. Mm-hmm. There's also just a much more fractured media environment that there was an opening that Jonah and Steve saw for something on the center-right that wasn't partisan, and I don't even mean Republican versus Democrat partisan,
right.
but small p partisan,
right.
agenda-driven.
Steve formerly of the Weekly Standard, Jonah formerly of National Review.
Correct.
Right.
And for them, so that there's the where it falls on that spectrum. There's also the where it falls on the new media delivery spectrum. They see this more as newsletters and podcast-based.
Mm-hmm.
So for those of you listening to podcasts, boy, have we got some things for you. And, you know, my role, as I see it, will be writing a lot of explainer pieces. You know, do you want to know all of the people who are being discussed to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Supreme Court should that opening happen? Who are they? Why? You know, pros and cons. Mm-hmm. How Democrats can take back the Senate in 2020. What's possible? What's the likelihood? So less breaking news, so-and-so said something about such-and-such according to anonymous sources, and more, how does this work? What does this mean? You know, if you are heading home around dinner and someone asks you what's going on with the trade deal, this is going to be more, what do we have now? What is this going to do? Versus, you know, so-and-so said something mean about such-and-such about the trade deal.
Mm-hmm. So you're podcasting, you're writing, and you're doing TV for CNN.
Yeah.
Which is your favorite? These are three very different skills.
I've always thought of myself as a writer first.
Writer first.
Yeah.
Okay.
I love writing. I love grammar. I mean, I'm sure there are much nerdier people, but like me with William Safire's old On Language columns,
right,
and, you know, a cozy blanket and one of my cats. I have two, so either one will work. I mean, that's like the pinnacle of happiness for me.
What I miss about Safire is his New Year's quiz column.
Ugh, everything. I miss everything.
I try to write one each year along those lines, and it's just so bad compared to what you come up with. I mean, I try to be clever about it, but it's just not the same. That man just had a gift for this.
And, you know, my Strunken White is well-worn. There's a craft to writing that I enjoy. And, you know, I compare TV to a tasty dessert.
Mm-hmm.
But like you still, if you only have dessert, you're going to miss having like that great vegetable. Like,
so explain cable television to those listening who have not done a hit, have not sat in front of a remote camera with an earpiece talking,
yeah,
to somebody they can't look at, or have not been on a set and had a hit go by in 30 seconds and not realize just how quick it is. Just talk a bit about that experience. I've done television myself and I find it daunting.
You know, I do media training a lot for folks, and when I was at the Department of Justice, we had 90-plus U.S. attorneys that I would do media trainings with, and
mm-hmm.
The hardest thing I find for most people is not letting your eyes dart, because if you're having a face-to-face conversation with someone, it would actually be very disconcerting if you stared at them the whole time without moving your eyes off of their eyes the whole time.
Right.
And yet in TV, you're in what I call these little refrigerator rooms, in part because they're incredibly cold usually.
Yes.
But they're, you know, black and soundproof, and it's you, a chair, a desk, a screen behind you, and a camera in your face, and you just have to stare at that camera without moving your eyes. And if your eyes dart, it is incredibly disconcerting to the viewer.
Right.
And so staring straight ahead and maintaining that while saying whatever you want to say, you get used to it very quickly, but for the uninitiated, that's a hard thing to train people to do. You know, there's always that feeling when you get off TV also of like, oh, I should have said that. You know, like there was another thing I should have said, but it's so short. And you're trying to often talk about very big ideas and complicated ideas in an incredibly short amount of time, but also in a way that a whole range of people watching can grasp onto. And I don't mean dumbing it down. I mean, you know, they don't have an hour beforehand where we've only been talking about this to get into the weeds about, you know, take the IG report, what that single footnote says. Well, you can't talk about the footnote unless you talk about the executive summary.
I think that's probably the most disheartening thing you hear when you're on television. You have 15 seconds.
Go. Yeah, so it's not TV's fault that it's hard to have nuance. It's that it's hard to have nuance in any situation where you are trying to talk about big ideas to people who may be coming in and out of that conversation.
Let's talk a bit about the Senate hearing that went on yesterday.
Yes.
Well, a little less attention to what happened on the other side of Congress, but
yeah.
Interesting nonetheless. What did you learn from that?
And you're referring to the Inspector General,
correct,
of the Department of Justice, Michael Horowitz, comes to that Senate hearing. So the report, by the way, like my new pet peeve is people who say the report's 430 pages. The page numbering is 430, but it's 476 pages. If you wanted to print it, you would need 476 pieces of paper. There's an executive summary and there's an appendix, whatever. So it's 476 page report. I think the biggest things for me are that very predictably everyone claimed victory.
Right.
And they made it immediately a partisan conversation. Democrats saying, see, we had the predicate to open the Russia investigation. The president lied. His wires weren't tapped. And on the right, Republicans immediately saying, see, there was FISA abuse. We said it from the beginning. You mocked us. How dare you? Where are our apologies? The president was right. Those conversations to me are incredibly uninteresting compared to what the report said and what it means moving forward for the FBI and for our FISA process and just sort of trust in institutions that I think have been fading a lot. So on the one hand, I think Chris Wray has the hardest job in Washington, and I've said this and I continue to say it, but that report found repeatedly in what I think can only be described as a culture of law enforcement officials at the FBI not wanting to report up through their chain of command because they were afraid it was, quote, politicized. Well, the FBI director reports to the deputy attorney general, who is a political appointee. And so Chris Wray's biggest challenge now is inculcating a culture where law enforcement decisions are not improperly influenced by politics, but where his agents and his institution is accountable to political appointees. That is the mission of the FBI, but it is a contradiction in some ways. And I think that a lot of the problems that were cited in that report come down to that basic tension. And I think Chris Wray recognizes that tension. I think he wants to solve that tension. But if anyone thinks that's a snap your fingers and have 36,000 FBI employees say, oh, no, we got it. No problem. I see exactly where that line is.
Right.
Not so easy. The second part is on the FISA process moving forward. And the inspector general said that he would open another investigation into the FISA process generally because, of course, if you're working on a FISA application that you know is going to be getting almost, the most scrutiny of any FISA ever, I don't think that's an overstatement at this point.
Right.
and you did this? This was how you treated it? These were the steps you skipped, the omissions you accepted, the shortcuts you took. What the hell's going on with the rest of the FISA? So I think that if you're imagine for a second being one of the few, but several FISA court judges who signs off on these, and you just read that report, I got some questions for the next attorneys coming into my chambers.
This is what's interesting to me about this whole impeachment saga. On the one hand, you could say some of this is just a one-off. It's Trump comes into office, the Democrats just deranged by the fact this man is office. He could not have legitimately won the election. There has to be something crooked that happened. Well, if we can't prove collusion, well, we just find another way to go after him, and we have this process. And that's a one-off. We've now gotten out of our system. But you're suggesting that perhaps, especially with the FISA situation, there are actually deeper, more institutional problems here that we're getting into.
I do think so. And I'm an attorney by education, if not trade at this point. And I worked on a couple cases of Brady violations where a prosecutor intentionally withholds material to a defendant. I have never seen a case where the prosecutor intentionally withheld a potentially exculpatory information from a defendant who he believed was innocent. You do that when you, as the prosecutor, are just so sure in your bones that the guy is guilty. You frame people you believe are guilty. You don't frame people you think are innocent. So a deep problem here, a problem that's much harder to fix, is these people's motivations that I am aware of were not bad in the sense that they weren't saying, I don't think he did it. Let's take him down anyway. F the man.
Right.
They thought he did it. And I don't think that's a one-off, because I think that that can apply to anyone, not just Donald Trump.
Right. You could switch parties. You could have Republicans, Democratic president, and so forth.
And I don't, we talk about the deep state or the bureaucracy. My experience is that it's not, again, an R versus D issue. It's not partisan in that sense. It's an expertise partisanship. It's a we know better partisanship.
I want to shift gears now and talk about something in your background, and that's Republican and Republican candidates. Overlooked in this election is one fact, that whether Donald Trump wins or loses, well, maybe not so much if he loses, because he could run again
if he lost in 2020. He could run again in 2024. I don't think that's likely, though.
Fun little trivia about the Constitution.
You learn something every day, folks. But the fact is, on election night in 2020, somebody's going to be very happy, somebody's going to be very sad, and a lot of people are going to be angling for the 2024 election. And
this is the second conversation I've had today about 2024. I feel like it's in the air this Christmas.
It's Washington. Mm-hmm. But you, my friend, have worked for some of these people. So it is not a stretch to say that Ted Cruz could be very much on TV on election night 2020. And Mitt Romney might be on TV. And maybe Carly Fiorina comes back on TV. There are a lot of Republicans out there running. Let's talk a bit about the Republican Party and life after Donald Trump.
This is the big question. I think that there are two camps in this. And one camp I do think is just wrong, and I think that camp is getting smaller and smaller. And that's the camp that thinks, post-Donald Trump, we just sort of go back to pre-Donald Trump. There is no way in any world that I've seen that the Republican Party just sort of pretends that this was an aberration, and we go back to... For lack of a better term, the Paul Ryan, Mitt Romney era of the Republican Party.
Right.
And so then the question is, what is a post-Donald Trump era that's for the Republican Party that is truly post? It's still an evolution of that. I think that's a much harder, more interesting question, frankly. I think Nikki Haley is someone who's trying to define that for herself. Mm-hmm. Tom Cotton, I think you will see come out and try to carve a unique version of that as well. I'm not sure that people who ran in 2016 will be a big part of that conversation, actually.
Really?
Because in some ways that's the pre-Donald Trump Republican Party. The parties have both shifted over the course of the last 3 years since he was elected. Mm-hmm. The Republican Party has changed on several policy issues, evolved, whatever term you want to use. And then because we have a two-party system, the parties tend to reach equilibrium. I compare it to hungry, hungry hippos. If there's balls left in the middle of that field, the hippos bang the table until they can, smash up all the little, eat all the little balls. So, if Republicans leave the free trade ball back into the center, the hungry, hungry Democratic hippo will go eat that ball over time if there are voters that are left in the field. So I think the parties will reach a new equilibrium. This is not particularly unusual in American politics. We've obviously had new parties emerge. That hasn't happened in a while. But since we've had a sort of stable Republican and Democratic party, those two parties aren't even close to what they were in the post-Lincoln Republican versus Democratic parties.
Right.
And I think we'll see that again, and I don't think we're done with it. I think we're sort of in the middle of that tectonic plate shift.
Okay, so you suggested that 2016 candidates are maybe not going to work out too well in 2024, but let me run at least two of them, actually.
Okay.
Well, I'd say three, John Kasich, because he's John Kasich.
Well, I'm sure he'll run.
Exactly.
But that's hardly the point.
Well, it might be like Mark Sanford's campaign. Sanford kicks off his campaign. He has like one person show up in Philadelphia for his kickoff.
That was awkward feeling.
That should never happen to anybody. I shouldn't be mean about Kasich, but he tries me.
That's such a sweet way to put it. Bless his heart.
Well, thank you. Yeah, you're from Texas, you could say that. But no, two 2016 candidates who stand out here. And one is Marco Rubio, who I don't know if he's going to run in 2016 or not, in 2024 or not, but he's giving speeches. He is going to Catholic University. He is talking about a more spiritual version of conservatism. I don't know how your publication feels about it. I know the National Review didn't care for it, the Wall Street Journal. But he clearly is thinking about life after Donald Trump for Republicans. And the other one is your former boss, Senator Cruz. So let's talk a bit about Marco and Ted.
I think that... So there are huge benefits to having run for president. I think there are two types of people who get their party's nomination. Mm-hmm. One is the moment meets the man candidates, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. It's their first time running, but because of the moment that we are in as a country and who they are as people, and like them or dislike them, it's hard to argue that each of those people aren't once-in-a-generation charismatic leaders. Mm-hmm. And so that moment meets the man, and we're off. Fairly unusual. If you are not one of those people, the only other way to get the nomination is to have run, really, before. Or at least to have run something large before, because you build up all of these things that make a presidential campaign so hard.
Right.
A donor base, a national network of grassroots volunteers. You know, it really helps if you're coming into South Carolina and you know which, you know, fish fry to go to.
Right.
So in that sense, 2016 candidates have an edge.
Right.
They already have all of that infrastructure. They've test run it once. On the other hand, I thought that Kamala Harris was, for instance, an excellent candidate on paper for the Democrats. Mm-hmm. But it didn't work out a lot. Like, you right. sort of can underline that. And why? And I think that her and Marco Rubio have a lot in common in this sense. On the one hand, her campaign actually looked a lot like Scott Walker's. They built an enormous infrastructure that was made to win.
Right.
And then if you don't take off, you can't sustain that infrastructure. That was the Scott Walker model. By the way, people make fun of that model. It's actually done by people who plan to win, not plan to come in third for a cabinet position. I think there's something quite honorable about that plan.
Right.
But set that aside. That's my little rant. The Marco Rubio problem, the Kamala Harris problem, was a failure to have a message that met the moment. It's almost the opposite of man meets moment candidates. It's, I want to be president candidate without really a raison d'etre of why they're there. I think it's hard once people sense that about you. It's not quite this, but it's a lack of authenticity in some ways.
Right.
I think it's hard to overcome that even if you do overcome it. Hmm. You know, can you imagine having that many millions of people try to judge who you are and whether you're your authentic self? And you do get better over time at letting people in, and it's not some character flaw that right. doesn't come naturally. But it's hard to overcome once people have that first impression of you. I also think, though, that the pre-2016 candidates, when it comes to Donald Trump, have a really hard case to make because they can't argue that they want to go back to pre-Donald Trump because he beat them. So that means that they're losers in that sense.
Right.
And then post-Donald Trump, why are we going back to these pre-Donald Trump candidates who didn't run on those things in 2016? There's going to be a lot of gaps between what they ran on in 2016 right. and what voters are interested in 2024. Marco Rubio probably, for the same reasons he had that gap in 2016, probably right. has even bigger gaps, deltas than in 2024. Ted Cruz maybe less so, but I still think that will adhere.
Right. So, you know, the Kamala Harris thing, I'm a Californian, so I follow Kamala quite closely. There were all sorts of problems with the campaign. There were logistical problems. She had a campaign operation in Baltimore. She had consultants back in California. Her sister was in California. That New York Times story when her campaign was collapsing.
It was a damning New York Times story.
50 people just dumping on each other. I mean, just it's like, you know, Bob Woodward writes books, but just it was a feeding frenzy of people just clearly just jumping on the corpse of the campaign. But the other problem, Sarah, was that the calculation was wrong. The calculation was that Democrats wanted a female version of Barack Obama, that they were going to respond to both just telegenics, but also you know, racial heritage. And if you look at the field right now, if you look at the front runners in the Democrat nomination, Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, those are not Obamas necessarily. So the wrong calculation. This is what I'm curious about for the 2024 Republicans. I know it's a long time away to 2024, but the question is, do Republicans want Donald Trump again? Are they looking for another Donald Trump?
We have seen this tested now, I think, in a variety of places. Special elections are 2018.
Right.
There is no Donald Trump. No one can run Donald Trump's campaign and run his playbook.
The governor of Kentucky tries to be Donald Trump.
Right.
And he is.
Not Donald Trump.
He loses a job because he's not Donald Trump.
Yeah. So I think candidates would be wise to have that reality in mind. And candidates tried that with Barack Obama. There's no other Barack Obama. Mimicking is the peak of lack of authenticity. Right. Donald Trump won because of after Mitt Romney, a campaign that I was part of, and Hillary Clinton, who their campaigns were afraid of their candidates by and large. It was how not to ever make a gaffe.
Right.
And then, so you get less and less and less to this tiny, tiny little nugget of awkward personhood. And then you have Donald Trump sweep in with 100% name ID, a media hungry for content after so many candidates becoming smaller and smaller, and this authenticity off the charts. Like, he's just himself at all times, no right. matter what. There are things to be learned from that, but don't for a second think you are that.
Right. The great example was Hillary did the Howard Stern show the other day. She sat down with Howard Stern. I don't know if I ever would have said in my lifetime that Hillary Clinton was going to talk to Howard Stern. And granted, Howard Stern is not what he was once a decade ago, or he just would have gone in and, you know, gone after her sex life and God knows what other pads. But instead, he's a different Howard Stern, so he played very nice with her.
Like, but when my cat got older and he just got far more docile.
Pretty much, yeah. But not that Howard Stern's been neutered. But you could just imagine in the 2016 world of Hillary Clinton, maybe she was approached to go on Howard Stern show. You could just imagine just the paralysis by analysis that would have gone on here. How many people in the campaign would have looked at it? How many debates and arguments and discussions and memos would have been about whether or not to do the Stern show? Somebody would have commissioned a poll to do it. Not it would have gone. And ultimately, they wouldn't have done it because they never would have come to a decision. Whereas now, she's not running, we think. So she does the Howard Stern show.
This is where I think a great lesson for future candidates is Pete Buttigieg. You don't think that Pete Buttigieg has anything in common with Donald Trump, but his comms strategy is actually the same.
Right.
All earned media, free media, they'll do any interview, hostile, not hostile, at all times. I think that we had comms professionals for way, way too long showing their value by saying no to things, that now a comms professional will show their value by saying yes to things. And I think that that's been the strength of the Buttigieg campaign, which was taken directly from Donald Trump.
Talk a bit about comms people in campaigns, because I come from the Golden State, where a lot of comms people have had very good livings working on campaigns, not always winning.
Well, I'm very good at not winning campaigns, so. So I teach a course at George Washington on crisis communication and campaign communication, and I think that because of Hollywood, House of Cards, even Veep, like, you know, we always say that DC is more like Veep than House of Cards. Doesn't matter. It's all the same. People don't think ethics play that big a role in your day-to-day life. Mm-hmm. And it should play, but it does play, whether you want it to or not, an enormous role. The hardest thing, I think, to teach my students is when you get asked a question, they have an instinct, because I think we all do since we're like 3 years old, to start from the lie and right. then move back from there, because you don't want to be a liar, to what's the closest thing to the truth that I can sort of say was not a lie.
Right.
When in fact, and I think this is where Donald Trump, Pete Buttigieg, others, but I also think it's in some ways a very ethical choice, they start from a place of radical candor and then back up from there.
Right.
I think it's a gestalt shift in comm strategy that we'll see moving forward.
But there's the other portrayal via Hollywood, and that's the movie Wag the Dog, where yes. Anne Hetch is a comms person, and she is an idiot, where she's constantly running around saying, what? I need talking points. I can't go out there without talking points.
And that's probably more Veep, right?
Like, right.
You know, it takes all kinds.
Well, now we have a president, Sarah, who is his own communication staff.
Absolutely. And we hear complaints that there isn't the daily briefing anymore, but I'm very sympathetic to the idea of why do you want a daily briefing if you can hear straight from the president?
Correct.
The press secretary served a very important role before we had the ability to speak directly to the American people. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump is not the first one to skip the press to get directly to people. Barack Obama did a very good job of it with the technology that existed from 08 to 16. They had, do you remember their weekly video that they put out that was watched by tons and tons of people? And, you know, shock of shocks, it didn't always mention the things that were on cable news.
So actually, you're too young to remember this, but Bill Clinton, after he was elected, I think in his first year, he goes to the press gallery dinner in the Capitol, you know, the one for the radio and TV correspondents mm-hmm. over there, not the big freak show up on Connecticut Avenue, which I guess you go to now. But this is the overlook. This is the ugly sister of the two. And he goes to this, and he gets up, and he tries to tell what he thinks is a funny joke. He goes, you know what I learned on the election last year? He goes, I learned I don't need you people. I could go with Larry King anytime I want to. I don't need you. Ha, ha, ha. And he looks around, and nobody's laughing.
Because it's true.
Because it's true.
Right.
So he's written the rules by doing satellite hits with Larry King.
And I think this brings us sort of full circle to how we started the conversation. We're in yes. such a different media environment right now where you are not necessary as a gatekeeper, as a reporter or journalist, to give the American people information. And so right. you need to add value in a different way. Same with those comms directors who were saying no. Maybe the thesis of my pod appearance today at Hoover is new ways to add value. And so as a journalist entering this field now, I think that's one of the fun challenges, is how do you add value when they don't need you to tell them what the president just said?
Right.
They saw it themselves.
But a good question for candidates and politicians moving forward, do I need fewer comms people and I just spend my time kind of driving my story by getting up at 5:30 in the morning and firing away on Twitter?
Right. I mean, what Donald Trump used during the campaign was a comms director, quote unquote, who was a full-time booker, basically. Because there is a scheduling. Yeah, I mean, hope. And I don't mean that to diminish her at all, first of all, because that's incredibly hard. But second of all, she had to build those relationships to know where you're going and when and who needs what answer. And, you know, did he eat breakfast this morning? Yeah, sure, he did, right. Whatever. But that's a very different role than the press secretary as celebrity role than it was becoming.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's circle back to the Dispatch and let's talk a bit about conservative journalism these days. You guys are kind of like a Democratic debate. Up on that stage, there is the National Review. There used to be the Weekly Standard, but there's now the Washington Examiner. There's the Washington Free Beacon. There is the Dispatch. There is the Daily Wire. There is the Daily Caller. There is the Washington Times. That's just seven off the top of my head. I guess I need three more for a Democratic debate. There are a lot of conservative entities out there, is the point.
Yeah, well, it didn't include Fox News. Yeah. Right. And then all the Fox News spinoffs.
Right.
All of those radio shows and all that. Ben Shapiro's podcast, or radio show. Mm-hmm. I think it's the number three radio show in the country right now. Mm-hmm. Rush Limbaugh. Drudge Report still out there and still quite influential. So, sorry, I'm extra agreeing with you.
Right. But you have all of these conservative outlets and markets, and they differ on Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Is the Dispatch have a formal opinion about Trump? I know Steve Hayes is not a fan of Donald Trump's, and heaven knows Jonah Goldberg is not either. but are you trying to market yourself as kind of a non-Trump group?
You know, my take on that is that I think it is a shame that most conservative outlets have had to define themselves as that. I'm not surprised by it. It is what it is. Mm-hmm. But it's a failure of imagination in some ways. I think that Jonah and Steve would answer that by saying, we're going to agree with the president when we agree with him, and we're going to disagree with him when we disagree with him. I think my personal take and what I see my role as is not agreeing or disagreeing, but explaining what's happening so that you can agree or disagree. You know, I think of my role more as analyst than sayer of opinions.
Well put. What is the future, you think, for all these publications? There's one school of thought that there's going to be a very healthy debate about the Republican Party. That's why I brought up the 2024 campaign beginning on election night 2020. On the other hand, life becomes a lot less interesting without Donald Trump in the middle of it.
Donald Trump has that great line at his rallies where he says, I think the New York Times might endorse me because I've been so good for business.
Yes.
It's a joke, but it's a... It's a knowing joke, you know?
Yes.
no question, Donald Trump has been good for business, for the media. There have been things that have been really bad for business in the media. The fact that we're losing local news, reporters bemoan that fact.
Still see a lot of layoffs happening.
A ton of layoffs, and it's terrible. It's, you know, the number one, the last Pew poll on the number one most trusted source of news for all Americans, and it's not close, mm-hmm. is their local news. So to lose that and the quality that had, you know, go back and read Boys on the Bus in 72, and the one thing that'll strike you most that's different is that those local news guys were oftentimes far more respected than the national guys. Being a White House reporter at that point was kind of a crap gig.
Right.
You know, you sat there as a stenographer, like the White House told you this, like, okay, I'll write that down. You know, it was guys at the Baltimore Sun and the Boston Globe and papers that don't even exist anymore.
Right.
So I think that's a bummer. But I didn't mean that to sound flip, really. Like, it's bad. But that's, you know, how the system works. I think that the media post-Trump will also, similar to the Republican and Democratic parties, is going through its own shift of
right. How
to reach people in a way that is meaningful and providing information in an era where they can get a lot of that information themselves in the way that they want to. And this is part of the problem, right? You can only get the news that you like, that you agree with.
Right.
And never have to hear the stuff that you disagree with, whether it's on Twitter or Facebook or otherwise. So why tune in to the New York Times if you're not going to agree or if they're going to give you both sides, and yet that is the core mission of a place like the New York Times.
Precisely. Let's talk about Washington, current Trump and post-Trump.
Okay.
What happens to this town once impeachment runs its final inevitable course, which I imagine will be sometime early mid-February when the Senate comes to its conclusion?
I was going to say we all enjoy our Valentine's Day and move on.
Easy to say, but does this town move on from impeachment?
I think so. I think that because it has been such a long process, long in some ways, short in the span of history perhaps, but one thing that I think has been different this time versus the Clinton era to some extent, but certainly Nixon to a larger extent, and like, God forbid you go back to Johnson, although great book out there on Johnson's impeachment. It's called Impeached. And you want to like, think that maybe we're okay right now, go read that about, I mean, the bribery and the drunkenness, and it's fun. There's no new facts coming out because the media has done such a good job of it. It comes out one at a time. But can you imagine, for instance, take the Mueller report. If when the Mueller report dropped, everything in that were new information to you,
right.
It would have been a totally different reaction. And I'm not sure that any president could have survived that. But instead, there was very, very little news in the Mueller report at that point because right. So much of it had come out piece at a time. I think impeachment's a lot like that. And I think, you know, like frogs sitting in the water as it gets hotter, each news story raises the temperature a degree. And now we're just like, oh, I like this little hot tub I'm sitting in. So at least as far as Washington's concerned, I think it is considered far more theater that Nancy Pelosi is maybe an unwilling director and producer of. Though don't underestimate, I think she's one of the most brilliant political strategists out there. I think Mitch McConnell gets a lot of credit for being a brilliant strategist. And I think one of Nancy Pelosi's greatest strengths is that she's not seen as a strategist, but she's fabulous at it.
Right.
And now to watch them get to go head to head, which is so rare because normally they're in their own little House versus Senate spheres. That's been sort of interesting. But, you know, I think impeachment will be a non-entity. It may even be a non-factor except for riling up Donald Trump's base for 2020 even. I mean, that's so far away in a news cycle that churns so quickly. What'll be more interesting is if Donald Trump wins, he will almost certainly be the first president to be impeached twice.
But the purpose of impeachment was to rile the Democratic base.
Yeah, I don't...
No?
I think that every poll that I've seen has shown that it has done far more on the Republican side. Mm-hmm. Back in September when this was initially happening and the whole thing was rolling downhill, and again, I think people were learning new facts, is when the numbers were really moving towards the Democrats. It stagnated. If anything, it's pulled back a little bit towards the Republicans as fewer and fewer facts are coming out. And there's a sense, I think, among the Republican base, a defensive sense. I think the Democratic base wants to win the White House so badly, I don't think they think that there's any chance of removing him from office. And
right.
So it's less important to them in the sense that we tried, it's not going to work, now we just have to go through the motions.
But you think there could be a second term impeachment because you look at impeachment, this is the second impeachment in 20 years, and that came 25 years after the other impeachment, which is 105 years after the previous impeachment. But you're suggesting another one a couple years after the previous one. But the first thing that comes to mind is Donald Trump with the famous comment about shooting somebody on, what, Fifth Avenue or Park
Avenue? Fifth Avenue, I think.
What would have to happen to merit going through impeachment again? Because we can talk about media and we can talk about Democratic base and all that, but you have to have the justification for going through the process. I'm just trying to put my head around what kind of accusation, what kind of crime could be out there that would warrant going through impeachment yet again, especially since he would now be a lame duck president. You can't use the excuse of rigging another election.
Yeah. Right. No.
You're right. Clinton was, and so was Nixon.
And so was Nixon.
Good point.
Johnson wasn't, though, so.
No, he wasn't.
Johnson, though, I mean, so many weird things about poor Andrew Johnson, who I think I would have voted to impeach, even though he actually probably is the one guy who didn't do anything impeachable.
Well, nobody's figured him for the Lincoln assassination yet. In Conspiracy America Today, he would have been, believe me, somebody would have done a report on that.
I think Ted Cruz did that, actually.
Isn't it interesting? He's the only one to survive. No.
Yeah, I mean, he was part of the initial four that were supposed to be assassinated, and his guy just turns around and decides not to do it. Seward, of course, gets stabbed.
Sort of like being Suge Knight in the car next to Tupac, right? Mm.
Now that is a reference you didn't think you were going to get on the Hoover Institute podcast.
No, that is true. No, but you think they could go back to the well and impeachment again, because at some point this becomes comical in the pursuit of the man.
I think that President Trump will not be chastened mm-hmm. by this, and I don't mean to say emboldened in some way of like he's going to go break the law because of it, but I think he does him, like that's his. How he got to where right. he is. You know, this Ukraine call happened the day, I'll get this slightly wrong, so please do or don't fact check me, but I realize I'm playing fast and loose here. The day after the Mueller testimony is when this Ukraine call happens. So it's not like he thinks to himself, well, I really need to rein this in for a couple weeks and just play it like close to the vest. Like, right. No, that's not who he is. I don't know what the next thing is, but I wouldn't have guessed Ukraine either.
Right. Right. Very good. So for all this talk about 2024, let me run one final question at you. Why would you want to run if you're Republican in 2024?
If he wins or loses?
If he wins. Because we can look, A, at the history of the beast, which yeah. is that two-term presidents are then succeeded by somebody very opposite for another 8 years. So the American people are going to go with a very opposite Democrat, whatever the opposite of Donald Trump is, the Democratic Party. Have fun with that one, if you will. So whoever is running on the Republican side, given A, that, and then B, potential Trump fatigue. You think about what Bush fatigue was in 2008. My God, what multiple would it be for Donald Trump in 2024? The Republican will just not have a snowball's chance of getting elected president in 2024. So should we really be talking about this as maybe a 2032 challenge for the Republicans?
I think there's a great chance you could see some candidates, potential candidates, decide to sit it out. Mm-hmm. However, like I said, one surefire path to the nomination, if you're not that once-in-a-generation man-meets-moment candidate, is to have built that national foundation, donor base, staff base, early state base. And the best way to do that, that anyone has found really, is to run and lose gracefully. You don't want to get the nomination, because you don't get a second bite at that apple, rarely. Unless you're Adlai Stevenson, right? Like he got the nomination.
Two-time nominee's Richard Nixon.
That's a good point. Recent history, my life history.
Right.
But I do think we've seen more people. And some of this might just be numbers. We haven't seen so many people run for president in a long time that
right.
it used to be the case that running for president was just sort of always a net gain.
Yeah.
We did see in 2016 and 2020, I think already, that it can be a career ender if you're Beto O'Rourke and you don't understand the moment you're in, or you're just not quite up to being able to run for president. So I do think there are some risks, but I think you'll still see plenty of people run. I don't see how Nikki Haley doesn't run. She doesn't have to, but I think she will. Tom Cotton would be a type of candidate you could see who decides to sit out. Like, watch Tom Cotton and see what he decides, because that will be the people, you know, the type of person who could say, I'm young enough, I don't need to do this, I can wait. We're absolutely going to lose, so I'll just wait till 2020.
Final question. A lot of names come up in this conversation, like Tom Cotton, like Nikki Haley, Josh Hawley from Missouri.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I forgot Josh. Forgive me.
Give me a name of Republican we're not talking about who we should be talking about.
For 2024?
Yeah.
It's a great question. You know, the governor model has fallen by the wayside recently, but...
That was my first thought, because... Two of the most interesting governors out there probably could not get nominated by the party, and that is the governor of Maryland, the governor of Massachusetts, Charlie Baker, and
Larry Hogan.
Larry Hogan, yeah.
You know, Haslam has always been interesting, and he has the money. He doesn't seem that interested, though.
Mm-hmm.
So there could be some governors, but it is hard now to run a race with zero name ID. Buttsy, Pete Buttigieg, I'm not saying there aren't exceptions.
Right.
But that's hard. You know, you could, I think Will Hurd, for instance, is someone who might be familiar to folks in D.C.
Texas congressman.
Texas congressman, former CIA, lots of foreign policy cred, just a...
Now leaving Congress.
Now leaving Congress, but clearly going to stay involved.
Right.
That's someone who could build a base, probably not for 2024, as we've talked about, for obvious sort of post-Trump. Every question you're going to get asked is how you fit into a post-Trump world.
Yeah.
but he's young. So a 2028 Will Hurd could be a very different looking Will Hurd than 2019 soon to be former Congressman Will Hurd.
Good point. Good point. Hey, Sarah, come out to Hoover sometime.
Absolutely. I mean, gosh, we're sitting, there's snow on the ground here, and you're inviting me to California. Yes, I will.
Good. If you do the podcast with me.
Done.
Thanks for the conversation. I enjoyed it.
You bet. Me too.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th president of the United States. And for, of course, this conversation, whoever the 46th president is going to be. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word. Get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Hoover's fellowship to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Sarah Isker is on Twitter. Her Twitter handle is, you're going to have to explain this to me, @WhigNewton. That's WHIGNewton. N-E-W-T-O-N. Clearly, you like 19th century political parties.
Yeah, no, I liked combining Newton, the physicist, with the party of the Whigs. I like history. I like science. My favorite book is Bill Bryson's A Short History of Nearly Everything. So if you need to know much about me, like that book, just read a summary of it, and like that's sort of me.
So your college thesis was Millard Fillmore, unappreciated genius, right?
I have a friend who's obsessed with Polk, so yeah, that's about right.
Very good. Sarah Isker's fine publication I mentioned, The Dispatch, is available at, not surprisingly, thedispatch.com, www.thedispatch.com. Anything else I need to plug for you?
No, that's great, and definitely we... Especially right now, our hard launch is January 7th, so we're in sort of a soft launch mode right now. Send feedback. Let us know what you like and don't like and what you want more of or less of.
And where do we find your podcast?
Everywhere. Apple, Stitcher, iTunes, wherever you're getting your podcast, we're there. Jonah Goldberg's The Remnant. Advisory Opinions is me and David French on legal stuff and culture. I think he wants to talk about DC versus Marvel this week, and I can't tell you how little I know about or have opinions about this. So definitely give us feedback. DM me on Twitter. My students tell me not to try to use slang around DMs because I get it wrong. So just DM me. I don't know whether it's slide into my DMs. That means something, I guess. So okay. I'm too old now.
Once again, @WhigNewton, WHIGNEWTON. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, iTunes U, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.